Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivastari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
So one of the elements that also has been, that Prabhupada brings out is this element that the Mayavadis talk about of reflection. They're saying it's just like, as the Vedas mention it, as that, and they'll say it's a reflection. But, and as a reflection's not real, therefore the material world's not real. But the weakness in their argument is, but what it is reflected from is real. Right? Because if it's actually a reflection, so then Brahman is there. Right? It means if the jiva is conditioned or covered by illusion, does Brahman stop to exist? Right? No, even according to their philosophy. So that means at that time there's two. So if there's a reflection, you can see Brahman and you can see the jivas. So what does that mean? Right? It means... There's two. It means in the original that is being reflected, there are two. You understand? If you can see Brahman in this material world, that means that's because there's original Brahman, and that is being reflected here. But if you see that, so that works for them that way. But if you reverse the thing, the logic's the same the other way. So if you see the jivas here, that means because there's originally that they're there. You understand? So the problem with these is they'll be using faulty logic. They won't take the logic far enough, right? They only take it far enough to deal with what their purpose is, right? That makes sense. You know, so Prabhupada mentions that one also as a another one of their foolish arguments, right? In verse 26-30. Krishna shows that there's no reason for lamentation, even if Arjuna does not believe in the existence of the eternal soul. Right? Because if you just say, even you're going to take the materialistic point of view that the life comes from dead matter. Right? So, then what's the big deal? It's just a transformation of dead matter. If it goes back into dead matter, what's the problem? And anyway, they're going to die anyway. So it's not like it's a big, you know what I'm saying? You know, if you take into the modern science, you have they'll take the body as a sack of chemicals. I'm not sure how much it's worth these days. Everyone knows how much the chemicals in the body is worth these days. I mean, when I was a kid, it was worth about $5.26 or something. So I'm not sure what it's worth now. I'm sure inflation has gone up a bit. You know what I'm saying? So what's the lament? The cycle of birth and death is certain and applies to everyone. So many living entities are born and die at every moment. What is the use to grieve for them? It's just because if you're looking at it, just comes from matter, it's not a big deal. So then why would you be lament about it? Right? So he's using, an atheistic argument here. Or, as Srila Prabhupada puts it, no one laments for the loss of a certain bulk of chemicals and stops discharging his prescribed duty. Right? You're walking along and drop a sack of cement and then it gets ruined. You don't, that's it, and your life's finished and everything. Yes?
On that argument, though, you don't have a relationship with that person anymore.
They're not in the form. Means if you're looking at what's lost. The relationship is lost. But you can't lament for the body. Because that's just made out of dead matter that's going to go back to dead matter. But in the discussion here, those that make these arguments generally don't bring up the emotional aspect. Because they don't really think that far. Right? That would be a different group of materialistic thinkers. Right? In other words, technically speaking, anyone with mundane consciousness, then life or the soul has come from matter. Right? So the gross materialists or the varieties of karmas, you're going to have those that only believe in one lifetime and those who believe in many. Right? Same with the other school, the pessimistic school, where you can't be happy in this world. They'll also only believe in one life or in many. Right? So then, but in any case, for the materialists who don't know anything about the Vedas, then life is coming from matter. Right? It's just a combination of the elements creates, generates the life. So by that combination, consciousness is generated. You know, they can't say how that would happen because nothing else that you know of, consciousness is generated. Right? You know, it's like your coffee table, you know, never just by chance one day becomes conscious or something. You know. So that doesn't happen. But people get distracted and somehow or another it works for them. Right? Because you're interested in matter and you become inspired by matter, you're attached to matter, so all your emotions are included with matter. So then the idea that from matter, therefore, consciousness comes isn't that far of a step. Right? Because you think it's the matter that made you inspired or gives you that feeling of need. Right? And by working with it, it's transformed. Right, so the concept that you could transform the energy and life could come from it, then isn't that far of a step for them. Does that make sense? But the problem is they're an illusion because they don't understand that inspiration they have is not coming from the dead matter, it's coming from the Lord. So they don't see this. Right. Then, on the other side is that the impersonalists, the voidists, then they are also saying that there is no individual life. There's only Brahman. So when illusion is covered by illusion, then there is individuality. Then there's that specific separate life. Right? So what is illusion? What is illusion equated with? Yeah, the material energy. Therefore, life is still coming from the material energy. So you find all mundane concepts of philosophy and religion, the living entity will come from the material energy. Like that. They'll say it comes from God, this and that, but in actuality, why is there? Why is it happening? That's because of the thinking is because of the material energy. So they don't understand that. That's why Krishna first starts out with him and the living entities are eternal. They've always been there. Right? Because if you establish that point, then one, you get rid of all the materialistic things because we haven't come from the matter. So matter is what's foreign. Right? So God and the living entity, that's what's common. So that's where the relationship lies, not between the living entity and the material energy. Right? Nityo nityanam. Right? The greater eternal is connected with the smaller eternals. The material energy is not eternal and is not conscious. Right? And so, if it's not conscious and it's not eternal, then that combination can't make any happiness. Right? Because happiness means it's the result of combining the field with action. Right? Does that make sense? So then, that leaves the, so that would get rid of that aspect. And if you say that the God and the living entities are eternal, that gets rid of all your Mayavada and your Buddhism. You know, all your pessimistic philosophies that, yeah, the material world's bad, so we'll stop interacting with it and we'll elevate ourselves out of here. you know, back to a position of non, how you say, you know, lack of anxiety, the so-called Vaikuntha platform of existence, but without Vaikuntha, right? So it's not, doesn't work quite well. Because if, see, easily they could have called Brahman Vaikuntha if they wanted, but they didn't, right? The planets are Vaikuntha. But when it's mentioned Vaikuntha in the scriptures, then the Mayavadis will take it as Brahman. They think that's Vaikuntha. It means it's the place with no misery. But the point is you say it's a place of no misery. And so is that a nice concept? If you could have a situation where you would never be unhappy, never be in anxiety, never disturbed, would that be good? It would be boring in the long run, but I mean, is the concept appealing?
Yes.
Yes. But the point is why is the concept appealing?
It's the nature of the soul.
It's the nature of the soul.
And there's so much misery here.
There's misery here, okay. That defines it. But what point is coming out here that pokes the hole in the Mayavad philosophy? But it's for themselves. It's for their pleasure. Yes, it's not for Brahman's pleasure. But that's the point. If it's for their pleasure, it can only be pleasure if you exist to experience it. You understand? For Brahman, if there's only Brahman, it's all one. There is no anxiety in the first place. So why would it be a drive to get back to the stage of Brahman? Because you're already Brahman. See, this is the difference between the Mayavadis and the Brahmavadis. The Brahmavadis is we're Brahman anyway. So our anxiety is coming because we don't understand that. But we're already Brahman. And everything around us is Brahman. So just relax. Right? But the Mayavadis, this is all illusion. We have to get back to Brahman. But the point is then that's almost saying that we're not Brahman now. Right? And it, you know, if you're saying yes, okay, it's illusion. So then why take the illusion so seriously that you would make so much endeavor? If it's an illusion, why are you working so hard? Does this make sense? So the point is that the individual can only appreciate the happiness of Brahmananda if he exists as an individual. Because if you say you merge back in Brahman, then you'll be happy. Brahman's already happy without you merging back into it or not. Right? Brahman doesn't need you to be happy. So you're establishing that you are actually the cause of Brahman's happiness. Right? When it's supposed to be the other way around.
Especially if you don't exist.
Yeah, and if you don't exist, then how are you going to... You know, so it just doesn't make any sense or philosophy. Right? They've been thinking about it for a long time, so they're quite good at discussing it. But it still doesn't make any sense. Yes?
May a Brahmavadi have understanding about Paramatma and Bhagavan?
May a Brahmavadi have understanding? No. He can move forward to those. Because once a Brahmavadi understands about Paramatma, then he's not a Brahmavadi anymore. Then he's, you know, he's on the Paramatma platform on realization.
And right? He still wants to have Brahman liberation, though.
And that's called a Patanjali yogi.
Okay.
Like that. That's called a real idiot. Right? Because it's like the impersonalists merge in Brahman, but they don't know there's a person. But to know there's a person and still want to merge into Brahman, that's stupid. That's unfortunate. You know what I'm saying? So the point is if one's on the Brahman platform, then one's liberated, so there's nothing stopping one's... there would be nothing to create a misunderstanding of what you're dealing with, right? There's no conditioning to, you know, cloud the vision. So that's why if a Brahmavadi an actual Brahmavadi comes in contact with the Lord, then he's on the transcendental platform. He knows he's only dealing with the transcendental platform, but this is a superior platform, so he accepts it. Does it make sense?
And would such a person come to pure bhakti immediately?
Pure bhakti means you can say pure bhakti, but at what point they come to pure bhakti?
But I mean, when they come in contact and they accept the Lord as a reality, because they have no conditioning, they move very quickly to accept prema.
That's another thing. But the point is the Brahman platform, and the platform of bhava are the same. The situation is the same. The difference is Brahman, you're only seeing the impersonal feature, while Bhagavan means you're seeing the personal feature. But still, you have to progress, right? It means the residents of Vrindavan who are practicing Bhava Bhakti, they're not conditioned. Right? So, but they have to make an endeavor to develop that prema. You understand? We have to get rid of the concept of the lightning bolt hitting us and then becoming enlightened. You know what I'm saying? Or that there's some mystic thing that we don't know about, that kind. Because mysticism means there's something you don't know. So it's like a septic form of watching horror movies. You know what I'm saying? That's very tamasic, it's based on the body, you don't know, like this. The mysticism is something higher, and, you know, like that, and it happens, you don't know how, and oh, wow. But you're not afraid of it, but it's still that same thing of ignorance, because you don't know. It's just a pleasant form of ignorance in this way, of, you know, while horror movies are a little bit more, you could say, a little grosser. Does that make sense? So these kind of attractions, then we need to give up, right? Because that's it, karma and jnana. And then sometimes the Prabhupada will mention yoga. But yoga is included within karma, right? It's within that. But sometimes it's brought out because of that element of the mystical attachment as opposed to the grosser attachment, you know, or the subtle attachment of the karmis. Does that make sense? You know, enjoy here, you know, or enjoy future enjoyment or heavenly planet enjoyment. You know, it's based on pious activities like that. But it doesn't have the mystical element, while yoga does. That makes sense? So that's many times brought out, you know, in these worldly religions and philosophies, like the New Age, and one of the elements is that the mystical side of it, you know, makes it attractive or something. So, you know, they add a little bit of everything. Does that make sense? So that's where it'll come from so it's originated in that, and then it filters through into all these different ways. So the point is that it's work, but it's nice work, because the soul is servant, so that's the natural work. Working hard to be master, that's the unnatural position. But working hard to be servant, that's natural. That's what they do. You know what I'm saying?
It's, you know, Lord Shiva putting the, you know, this act of, you know, being full of ashes and mistakes in the moon and skull. Is it for that kind of people to create this kind of mystique?
Is it to create the mystique?
Because such people are usually more attracted to Shiva.
Yeah. He actually wears all that. I mean, that would be a secondary reason. You know, like Krishna comes to associate with the devotees and kill the demons. Kill the demons is the secondary. Associate with the devotees is the primary. With Lord Shiva, it's to not associate with the materialistic demigods. That's why he wears all that. And as a secondary, it may attract the gunas. Does that make sense? So, like that. So. So it's basically the opposite of why Krishna does things. Yes.
What are ganas?
Ganas. Yeah. Ganas are the different groups that follow Lord Shiva. So all his, you know, sometimes it's translated as the hordes, like that. It just depends upon what aspect you're looking at. It means if you're looking at it, his associates and those who follow him, then they're ganas. If you're standing on a battlefield and they're on the other side, you generally call them hordes. Like that, because they may be a bit strange and a bit wild. Like that. But Lord Shiva being very kind, and therefore he takes care of them. Right. So does this make sense? So he's talking just on the bodily platform. So he's mentioned about the soul. The soul's eternal, so why should it be a problem? And as the soul is there, either they'll go back to Godhead, right? So, you know, Prabhupada's saying in the purport, why are you worried about killing Bhishma and Drona? They're great devotees, so they'll go back to Godhead. So what's the problem? Right? Is it the problem a devotee goes back to Godhead? Right, so he's saying you don't have to worry about it there. Right? And even on lower levels, if you're just seeing the pious activities, then they'll go to the heavenly planets or be born here again with a fresh new body. So as far as karma goes, then everything will be nice. Right? Then he's putting aside the element of the soul. Even if you don't believe there's a soul, just the body's going to die anyway. So why are you so worried? Right? So he's just bringing out all these different angles. Because in discussing, if one understands this hierarchy of arguments of the different schools, then you use them to establish your point. In other words, you only use an argument that is necessary to defeat the others. You don't use necessarily beyond. So that's why these other philosophies, they're based on Vedic literature. So they're correct up to a point. So up to that point, they're useful. Their conclusion, that's where the problem is. But like the logic defined by Gotama is very useful. But his conclusion, that's not what's not useful. So these things can be, does that make sense? You know, so here this would be something that would be expanding from, though people don't connect it, coming from Vaisheshika. Because his point is there's only atoms. And then by the influence of the Lord's energy, then these atoms are put together and they make all the different forms and everything that we see. And so with time, then the atoms just go back to their original state. Right? Does that make sense? So that's what we would call, you know, death or decay or anything like that. They're just going back to the original state. So his point is there's nothing to be too worried about. Because this is going on anyway. Atoms are coming together, atoms are going apart. And so because we identify with that, we become sad. But the problem, so this part is good. It's true. We'll say the same thing. But the problem is then he'll say, "Is don't worry about it, and then you'll, you know, come to the Brahman platform." And that's it. So that's a problem there. No, but the point is you should know where these atoms came from, and why they come together, and why they go apart. Right? So there's a person controlling that. So that person is controlling it, then you can have a relationship with them. So Vaisheshikas, they accept that person is controlling it, but they don't even consider for a moment that having a relationship with them is important. Does that make sense? Right? So this argument would be their argument. You know, it's just chemicals anyway. The chemicals means the combination of atoms. So they've all come together, and then now they'll all go apart. So then why are you worried about that?
Imagine one of the purport of the second chapter, Prabhupada. I can't recall the name, but he names two Sanskrit words that represent atheistic schools.
Yeah, no, you'd have to check what they are. Okay. Did you check those up? Or? Ah, okay, then here it is. From the purport of verse 26, it becomes clear that the atheistic propaganda is not a unique feature of our modern age, right? So here's another point, is that the modern man is so proud he thinks he's unique and special, right? But the point is, as Prabhupada's pointed out, they've always been there. There have always been this modern way of thinking has always been there. There was never a time it wasn't there. Right? Because modern means it's not either not based on the Vedic or it's not properly based on the Vedic. Like that. To reject the scriptures and to replace them with speculative theories which justify sense enjoyment is neither innovative nor admirable. There's always a class of philosophers almost akin to the Buddhists who do not believe in the separate existence of the soul beyond the body. When Lord Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita, it appears that such philosophers existed, and they were known as the Lokayatikas and the Vaibhashikas. Such philosophers maintain that life symptoms take place at a certain mature condition of material combination. The modern material scientists and materialistic philosophers also think similarly. According to them, the body is a combination of physical elements, and at a certain stage, the life symptoms develop by interaction of the physical and chemical elements. The science of anthropology is based on this philosophy. Currently, many pseudo-religions, now becoming fashionable in America, are also adhering to this philosophy, as are the nihilistic, non-devotional Buddhist sects. Right? So we see the point is that they justify their sense gratification, their endeavor, whatever it is, because of this. But basically all do this. If you ask those that are, you know, have some connection, you know, the Abrahamic religions, then they'll say the soul comes from God, but then they'll say, you know, the soul is the body. Right? So there's a point in there where they're also accepting this philosophy. But it's more unconscious. You know? If you don't ask, then they'll talk all nicely God stuff. But as soon as you ask, then they start taking up these philosophies.
So they don't have a philosophical background?
They don't have a philosophical background. Basically, there must be something, because you can get a theological degree. You know? And you can get a doctor of divinity. So that means you studied a lot of theology. But what actually that means, I'm not sure. Probably it means they study the scriptures themselves quite to some degree, but not necessarily that they actually know any philosophy. But from what I've heard, theologians have a more grasp of it, but still, it's not enough. They just have more crazy theories, that's all.
And a lot of it is just patch up whatever development is there in secular philosophy.
Yes, that's there.
What they have so that it doesn't crumble.
Yeah. There was a problem that came as, I think it was, Thomas Aquinas.
Yeah.
That he merged the Catholic doctrine with Plato.
With all the Greeks.
I don't, but specifically Plato, not Socrates.
But he used the logic of Aristotle.
That's just what Plato used. See, because Plato is not believing in Socrates' point of there's an absolute truth and you must adjust everything in line with that absolute truth. That ended with Socrates drinking his, you know, little drink. Because that's why he was killed, because he was saying there's an absolute truth. You know, a single absolute truth. You know, he wasn't sure. He's talking more like on the Brahman platform or something, you know, but he's not understanding beyond that. But because that got him killed, then we see that that Plato then avoided that point. Right? And then Aristotle brought it down to just, you know, basically that's what modern science is based on. So Aquinas merged these two. You know, because there was a problem, because the Christians were just saying you only had to have faith. and basically they work very hard to get rid of anything that you'd use your intellect for, in any kind of study of the material energy or movements of it and all that, that was considered nonsense, all Maya. So then, but by his time, then you had that the kind of secular thought and academic thought was starting to become more powerful. There were questions. I mean, you have 1,000 years of just saying, just believe. How long is it going to last? So that lasted that long. That's pretty good, you know, like that. Of course, you know, you might get your head cut off if you didn't. So, you know, you had inspiration to, you know, be involved. But yeah, so but at some point that wasn't working. And so then he merged the two, because they didn't really have any philosophy anyway, so it didn't matter. So as long as you could word it in a way that God was still the prominent feature, then it worked for them. But then the problem came is then that's where like Galileo and, what's his, the other one, Da Vinci and them would run into problems, because if you took that Aristotelian theory and actually applied it into the science, the development of the science at the time, it didn't work. You know that famous one, was it, you know, on the Leaning Tower of Pisa, he dropped the thing off and all the calculations that came from that, that's actually what got it, that was Galileo, no? I think that's what got him in trouble, because it disproved Aristotle's theory, which was what Christianity was now founded on. Right? So that was their attempt to be involved with it, and then now they'll absorb the Darwin's theory or these other things. They make these attempts where they don't have their own explanation philosophy, so they'll take on the modern thinking. So actually, these things means we may say no, they're very different, but actually there's not actually much different than this at all. It means the Buddhists are definitely in line with this. But then the other, major, if you take the Abrahamic, religions, that's basically most of the planet. I think there's 2 billion Christians, and there's, over a billion or so Muslims. I'm not sure how many Jews like that, but it doesn't matter. They're the chosen ones anyway. So the other riffraff doesn't matter, So it's, you're dealing with a huge amount of the population, a huge amount of the world. So on this, then they're based on this point.
What was the difference between Lokayatikas and Vaidvashikas?
That I'm not sure. We'd have to investigate into that. Yeah, I'm not sure. Unless the Vaibhashikas or Vaibhavas, I'm not sure. It means special or something like that, but it may be connected with Vaisheshika. Because that's the atomic theory, because he's going into scientists. So I think it would be something connected with atomic theory. So this has always been there. You had something? In verse 30, the Lord concludes His instructions on the immutable spirit soul. Srila Prabhupada summarizes. The Lord now concludes the chapter of instruction on the immutable spirit soul. In describing the immortal soul in various ways, Lord Krishna establishes that the soul is immortal and the body is temporary. Therefore, Arjuna as a Kshatriya should not abandon his duty out of fear that his grandfather and teacher, Bhishma and Drona, will die in the battle. On the authority of Sri Krishna, one has to believe that there is a soul different from the material body, not that there is no such thing as soul, or that living symptoms developed at a certain stage of material maturity, resulting from the interaction of chemicals. Though the soul is immortal, violence is not encouraged. But at the time of war, it is not discouraged when there is actual need for it. That need must be justified in terms of the sanction of the Lord and not capriciously. Right. So here the point is that one should take this philosophy and say, well, it doesn't matter. You don't have to interact nice. You don't have to deal nice. You don't have to deal with anything because it's all just, you know, how you say, chemicals anyway. But the point is that still would be atheistic. Point is that all these things have to connect to the Lord. You connect it to the Lord, then it actually becomes real. So Krishna defines what situations, under what situations you deal in which way with the other living entities who are embodied. Right? So that always has to be there. You always have to see that Krishna is going to establish what it is you do and what you don't do. So violence is one of the main, non-violence is one of the main principles of the Dharma Shastra. Right? But real non-violence is connecting the soul to Krishna. Right? That's real non-violence. To not do that, that's violence. That's the ultimate violence. Right? Because you may kill the body, that's violence, but killing the soul, right, by not connecting to the Lord, that's worse, greater violence. Right? So here then, if there is a reason for it, the war, then and it's based on religious principles, then it's justified. Right? Otherwise, then it's not. Then it's wrong. But in this case, then, it's justified. So then Krishna is encouraging.
Yes? That's why Prabhupada sometimes connects preaching to non-violence.
Preaching to non-violence. Yes, because that's you're doing the greatest welfare work. Because welfare is generally the opposite of violence, right? Because violence means the person, there's loss. But welfare means there's gain. Right? So this is the highest welfare is preaching. But some, being influenced by these kind of philosophies, then we'll think that preaching is, oh, that people don't like it. But that doesn't mean it's not there. Does anybody like, you know, that they have to have, you know, cardio surgery or something and they're going to end up with a big scar in the chest? No, nobody likes it. But it doesn't mean it's not done and people aren't benefiting. So in other words, you find a way that is least disturbing and you know, and most attractive, and you preach. But to say preaching shouldn't be done, or Harinam shouldn't be done, or we don't wear our devotional clothes because people will be disturbed, that's atheistic. You know, I mean, say it's for preaching, but it's not for preaching. It's for their own personal self-satisfaction. When they go out on the street, they want to get a particular reaction out of people. And they don't want it to be negative because they're Hare Krishna. So it's simply purely self-motivated. It's not something else. Because for every example, oh, this happened and then this reaction came and this came in the papers, there's devotees doing the exact same thing and it comes out positively in the papers. You know, it's like the scientists. They'll find something that goes with their theory, so they'll say this is true. But then something that goes against their theory, then they'll just stay in some, go down somewhere with some number on it and no one will pay any attention. Right, you know, so as Sariputta, you know, he points out is that modern man, skeletons of modern man have been there as long as they have, you know, all these other kind of skeletons. They've always been there, but they don't accept it, even though it's there. They just ignore it. You know, there may be, you know, pointing out there may it's so much that it's very obvious that they were always there, but they have this theory and they're attached to it. And so one may say, well, how does that happen? It happens in every field. Every field that happens. You know, it's just like you have just reading yesterday about this, the teaching of the English language, right? Then, and possibly even your other European languages that were, you know, Roman-based, your romantic languages, that they would, if you go back, you know, for the last, something like 1,000 years or something, then they would teach you the letters, the sounds of the letters, so that you could read, though you didn't know what it meant. Because up until, I think, the 1700s or something, you learned to read by reading Latin. Because they were all based on Latin, and all the sounds came out of Latin. So, therefore, the skill of reading, you don't have to know what it means. Right? So the kids would learn how to read. And then once they knew how to read, then they would hand them a Bible. And then that was their textbook. Because they could read perfectly. though they didn't know what it meant. Then they start reading the Bible. They learn vocabulary, what it means, but they can read perfectly. But at some point, a group of intellectuals came up with this idea that that's, you know, insulting because you're reading, you don't know what you mean. So you should bring it that it's meaning based. So then they start doing these things of words that you see the word and you know what it means. Therefore, you can read it. So it's just you memorize a symbol. So, you know, it means, why use that? They could have used Chinese letters. It's much more developed. There's 10,000 of them. So it's got a broader range of explanation than, you know, 26 letters. So if you're actually going to go by meaning-based, then, you know, the hieroglyphics is actually a better system. It's more, you know, you can catch the connection a little bit better. But in any case, they changed it into that. Starting in the 1700s, it came up by the early 1800s, that became like standard. It just took the place by storm, because to an adult, that sounds reasonable. But what they miss is that it's not reasonable to a kid, because a kid doesn't know what any word means. And to read a word, you have to know how to identify the syllables. So it's really a bogus philosophy. But right now, in all the schools in the world, that's what's going on. And that's why it's like, I forget what it was. 100 million Americans are illiterate. They can't read. Or their reading is at best fourth grade level. Right? I'm talking adults. Right? So there's 300 million Americans. Like that. From last I heard, maybe it's something this way or that way. 280 or something. But now, how much of that is children? Right? So 100 million adults is practically most of the adults. So that means only really sharp, intelligent people know how to read nicely. You know? So this is and the intellectuals have made this happen. And people will complain about it, but they won't hear, because it's, to them, it's a great theory. So it's the same with all this, because why I gave that example, someone would say, but it's so obvious how stupid it is. But there's so many things that are so obvious, but people buy it, because intellectually, it seems to make sense to them. You're going to say something? That's the whole thing. The whole thing is that you have to, from the beginning, you have to know what it means, otherwise they're missing out. But because you mix meaning with the actual phonics, they never learn to read. Like that. They just don't learn to read. You know, which is sad. And the problem about it is that those who understand the actual reading, they're at, because it's a science, while the others are working on an art. But what they forget is art's based on science. Art doesn't work without science, and that's why it doesn't work. So that's an example just there, you know, taking it out of the philosophical, and this is intellectuals. This is academics. These are PhDs. And they still don't understand. So like this, Maya is so clever, she can make everyone very illusioned. Right? Like that. Okay. In verses 10 to 30, the Lord defeats Arjuna's misplaced compassion, 127 to 129, using both Vedic and modern arguments. Right? So he goes back, he starts with the Vedic, and if that, even that doesn't work, he's showing, even in the modern, it doesn't work. It's just like we saw Prabhupada before, even you take the Mayavada philosophy, it still doesn't prove it. Right? It still doesn't prove there's no soul. So in the same way, he says, even on the modern thing, what's the problem? So it's a standard method. But the point is as it's pointed out here, it's not used capriciously. It means it's not used in your own idea. It's always based on Krishna. It's always based on the scriptures. So by doing that, then it becomes useful. Otherwise, if you make up your own thing, then it immediately becomes useless. Right? As soon as the wire is disconnected from the generator, it doesn't do anything. It's not doing anything. It's still the same wire, so fools can't see that. They can't see that it's not connected, it's not carrying the electricity, because they see the form. Verses 31 to 37. Krishna urges Arjuna to perform his Kshatriya duty, karma kanda. In verses 130 to 135, Arjuna refused to fight because even if he wins, he would not be able to enjoy the kingdom without his kinsmen. Right? Because he's saying the goal is to enjoy. Right? But that's not dharma. Right? That could be artha. You know? And his actual thing is himself enjoying, but it's being presented that, you know, share it with the relatives, so it's pranamoy, but his arguments are on the platform of dharma or manamoy, but we see actually his point, he is anamoy. He doesn't want to, he himself is not going to enjoy. Right? In verses 31 to 37, Krishna defeats this argument. Arjuna should fight because of the best way to secure his enjoyment. You want to enjoy, then yes, great, fight for your enjoyment. But you should actually know what your enjoyment is. Right? He's given a lower level of enjoyment, now a higher will be presented. By dying in the battle, he would attain heavenly planets, and by conquering the enemy, he would win the kingdom. On the other hand, if he abandons the battle, he would incur sin by neglecting his Kshatriya duty and would lose his prestige. The great generals would conclude that he ran from the battle in fear, and this would be most painful for him. Therefore, Arjuna should stand with determination and fight. So he brings it back down to a practical point. You want to enjoy, but there's only two ways you're going to enjoy. By fighting, you know, and winning or losing. In either case, if you fight, you'll enjoy. You'll either enjoy here, or you go to the heavenly planets and enjoy there. While if you take your philosophy and go to the forest, the others aren't going to take it, wow, he's such a great sadhu. They're not going to look like that. They're on the battlefield. In other words, why has he been talking for 14 years about battle? They've been talking longer, but this is obvious that they're talking. Vows have been made. You know, he's done all these things, and now suddenly he's not going to fight, you know, suddenly now become a sadhu. You know, that doesn't make sense to them. Of course, that's exactly what Dhritarashtra is hoping for. He's actually hoping that the influence of the dharma kshetra will make Arjuna see, you know, the higher principles. And he'll give up fighting and go to the forest. That's actually what he's hoping for, yes.
So what we see is just like a temporary relapse into that mood of the
Yeah, well, a relapse of the chef, but you could say, but it's a relapse, but it's a lower relapse. You know what I'm saying? Because the dharma kshetra could also make him more God conscious. You understand? The point is dharma would be followed, but on what level? So you have the dharma shastra, which is the varnashram system. So that's not what he's talking about here. Right? And he's professing it that he's compassion for others, but without it being based on dharma, it comes down to artha. And we see his real motive is kama. But he's not talking about dharma related to moksha or dharma related to the soul and bhakti. Right? So the field could have all the best. So the thing is it's not real dharma when you are talking artha and kama, unless it's directly in connection to dharma. Dharma shastra, following your duties that are prescribed, and it's beneficial for others, and there will be facility for enjoyment, that's fine, because it's rooted in dharma. Right? The nature of something. But if it's not rooted in that, then that's the point. He's not seeing that. he's giving up his duties, so then it will be sinful. Because of that, he'll lose his prestige. Losing his prestige, then the others will, you know, speak bad about him. So even out in the forest, they're not going to talk about what a great sadhu he is. They're just going to talk about how he's a coward. You know? You know, it's like if they were out in the forest, and having been in the forest, then they decided, why get involved in this? And they just got into penances and austerities and said, we're staying out here. Right? Then people might have said they became saintly. But they came back and asked for their kingdom and, you know, full force. They've arranged armies. I mean, that didn't just happen. They didn't just call up a few friends and say, hey, can you bring all your buddies? We're having a rumble. You know, it's like that. You know, it's like that. So it didn't exactly, you know, it was big work to, you know, organize that many kings. So now they'll just see it as weakness. They just won't see it another way. Right. Because otherwise, even if it was from that, it would have been done in a different way. He wouldn't have gotten fearful. He wouldn't have sat down. He would have just drove out there and just said, this is ridiculous. You know what I'm saying? They would have gone off with dignity. But here he's just, you know, it's not very dignified. Does that make sense?
All right. So up to verse 30, he was kind of giving some jnana to us, and now he's presenting this nishkamakarma.
Yes, because the point is your knowledge has to be applied. Right? In other words, let us say the devotee has knowledge. What will he do next? He'll apply it, because knowledge is sambandhigyan. Then what's after sambandhigyan? Avideya. And that gives you a result, prayojana. So now, he didn't have sambandhigyan, and then he saw that what he could gain, his prayojana, wouldn't happen. So therefore, he's not interested in avideya. But when Krishna changes it and points out that the sambandhigyan is different, the soul is added, then that changes your prayojana, therefore it changes the work. Right? It means the consciousness, not the work itself. So here, Krishna is then going back, okay, now you understand the soul, now let's fight. Right? And then it's kind of like, wait a minute, you said the soul and spiritual, and now you're saying fighting. You know, that doesn't make sense. Right? Can you open Sahu Kumar's doors? Does that make sense? Right? So that's the shortcoming. But it has to come out. You know, it means, in other words, the work is there, because if you have this understanding, then that karmakanda goes to a higher level. So he's presenting it that way because he's presenting it, but you don't see the whole picture. So therefore, it's called karmakanda. When you see the whole picture, it's karma yoga. Right? If you only see the work, it's karmakanda. Right? The work, the result. But when you see the bigger picture of the nature of the soul and all that, and the results for the Lord, then it becomes karma yoga. Right? But here, you know, he's being practical. In this way, Krishna shows that opulence and sense enjoyment come from proper performance of religious duties. Right? In other words, he's just being practical. Is that you want to enjoy materially, fine, but how are you going to get it? Are you going to get it by doing nothing? Running away to the forest? No, by performing your duty. Is your duty to be in the forest? Yes, but he's not a Brahmin. He's a Kshatriya. Right? He's a Grihastha. If he was a Vanaprastha, yes, then you better run to the forest. So he's saying is you're going to get by performing dharma. Dharma creates artha. Artha, then you can, there's sense gratification. So since you want to enjoy, kama with your relatives, artha, therefore you better perform dharma. Right? He's just even just taking his point there. So this is a continuation, like before, of just, you know, ignoring the soul and just taking the materialistic, and then taking, okay, you're talking all this dharma, then on this level also you're wrong. Right? So on the grossest material platform and scientific platforms, you're wrong. On the platform of karma, which you're discussing so much, you're still wrong. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like that example of Srila Prabhupada. Then, I forget what his name was. Shivananda? No, I don't know. When they were 22nd Avenue, next door, exactly next door, there's a petrol station. And so the boy came and he wanted $5 for petrol. And he was asked why, because, you know, what does he want to do? Well, he wants to buy a gallon of petrol to pour over himself and light himself on fire and kill himself because he feels so bad about something. I don't remember what. So then Prabhupada turned to Brahmananda or something and mentioned that he's crazy. And then in the discussion, Prabhupada said, do you know how I know he was crazy? Why was he crazy? What do you think? This is 1966.
Set up fine, his body is committed a bigger sin and he'd be in more trouble.
Okay, yeah, if he lights himself on fire.
Petrol wasn't expensive.
Yeah, petrol didn't cost $5 a gallon. In those days, I think it was like 25 cents a gallon. Right? So he wanted 20 times more the price, And it's right next door. They walk by it every day. They know how much it costs. So then he can say he's crazy. Because the point is he feels bad. He wants to kill himself. Okay, that's a natural emotion. And he's got his methods how he's going to obtain it, and all that. So then you could relate to that, but because he was asking too much, if he had come and asked for 25 cents, then they would have just dealt with, his emotions and stuff like that. But otherwise, they straightened him out and all that. And I think they called his mother and he came and picked him up, took him home and stuff like that. Yes.
Did Prabhupada first ask Brahmananda if they had that much money in the treasury?
Yeah, he may have. He may have also. Because, he went through it. Oh, you want $5 so you can kill yourself. Okay. Brahmananda, do we have that kind of, In other words, it's the same thing. Krishna's doing the same thing. You're going along with, okay. But you never lose control. See, the difference is devotees may go along with something. Okay, they want to do this or that, or, they don't want to do these, particular devotional things that make it obvious. So we'll go along with that, but they're not in control of it. Krishna here is going along with Arjuna, but he's fully in control of the philosophy and consciousness here. Prabhupada's going along with these, he's fully in control. These others are not in control, they are controlled. So that's where I will say, that's wrong. Time, place, and circumstance doesn't mean you lose yourself. It means you apply yourself to the time, place, and circumstance. But you always have to remember, who has created time? Right? What's Krishna's famous statement in the Gita?
Time I am.
Yeah, time I am. Right? So, he is time. Right? Place. Who created the 14 worlds? And all the situations you can find in the 14 worlds. Krishna. Okay. And circumstances. What are circumstances based on? Right? What people are there? What elements are there? And what are the relationships that define what could be done? Right? You have a room full of people you don't know. Same room, same time of day. Right? And you walk in and there's a room full of people you've never seen in your life. Right? So that creates one mood. We back up, right? You walk into the room again. It's full of people that you know. Right? We back up again. You walk into the room and, everybody there is carrying, some kind of a club or a sword or a stick like that, You understand? That changes the mood. Who's there? What's there? What facilities are there? That's the facilities of the place. But the relationship between the elements, that's the mood. Right? And a verb carries the mood. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah, so that means the time, place, and circumstance is connected to the verb. So it's the mood. And Krishna has defined what if you're with this person, what you do. If you're with that person, what you do. If this is your relationship, this is what you do. That's your, so where is the time, place, and circumstance that God's not included? That means that is a misunderstanding. That's a poor fund of knowledge. Because you don't see God. So they're talking like learned men, but they actually don't know what to talk about. It sounds great, and they're talking, you know, religion or morality or ethics or economics or justice. It sounds all nice, but like Arjuna, it means absolutely nothing. Right? So here's a technique. One, as you can see, is they're bringing out the element here, that you can see the difference between the karma and karma yoga, because you want to be able to distinguish that. You can't distinguish that, it's also a problem. At the same time, it's also showing methods of discussion, how you deal. The person's on the mundane platform, you discuss on their platform. But you don't come to their platform. You know, you're talking with a kid, he doesn't understand the words you're using. You deal on his platform that he can understand what you're saying. That doesn't mean now you become a 3-year-old kid. Right? So this is real application of time, place, and circumstance. So now, in an important purport to verse 31, Srila Prabhupada describes the performance of religious duties as the beginning of human life. Always remember this. Human life begins with the proper performance of duties. If it's not, that's what an animal is. Animal does what they like. Of course, the modes of nature define what they'll like, so they'll only work within that. But in, you know what I'm saying? So the animal is restrained and controlled, but that's not the decision of that individual soul in that animal body. Their mind is, I'm doing whatever I like, you know. But what if they've only given, you know, one thing to work with? You know what I'm saying? Because they're in ignorance, they can't see, you know. Does that make sense? So that's the point there. So human life begins when you follow your duty. So from the purport, there are two kinds of swadharmas, specific duties. As long as one is not liberated, one has to perform the duties of his particular body in accordance with religious principles in order to achieve liberation. When one is liberated, one's swadharma, specific duty, becomes spiritual and is not in the material bodily concept. In the bodily concept of life, there are specific duties for the Brahmins and Kshatriyas respectively, and such duties are unavoidable. Right? So one may say, oh, I don't believe in it, so it doesn't matter. But the point is, Prabhupada is saying here, if you're conditioned, you have to follow these. There's not a question. You don't want to follow them. You can. That's your choice. It's called sin. You follow them, that's called piety. It's not a matter, because we have to remember, is Krishna consciousness is not a mundane religion. Oh, I don't believe, I'm not a Krishna, now I'm this, or I don't believe in that, now I'm a Buddhist, oh, that's stupid, now I'm... Those are just external forms. You say you don't believe it, and then it doesn't work. It doesn't affect you. But it's not like that. Right? It's this God's creation, these are there, this is how He's established it. You perform the duties, you get the result. You don't perform the duties, you don't get the result. So it's a matter of, if you're on the bodily platform, you have to follow those duties to get what you're looking for. Because on the bodily platform, what are you looking for? Pleasure, yes, but material pleasure. So the only way you're going to get material pleasure is interacting with the material energy in the way God says you should interact. Then you'll get the results that you want. Right? So that's one. Yes?
I have a question about
duty. Yes.
Based on what you said about the animals following their own nature, can we say that dharma is acting according to something's nature?
Yes, dharma is acting according to the inherent nature. But the point is animals just do it because that's the way the modes of nature arrange it for them. But human beings have a choice whether to act according to their inherent nature or not. Ultimate inherent means the nature of the soul. That's why Prabhupada's pointing out there's two kinds of Swadharma. And then on the other is that if someone has a Brahminical nature, or in this case a Kshatriya nature, are they going to act according to that or choose not to? They act according to it, that's dharmic. They don't act, that's adharmic. And by acting according to it, you'll get the material facilities you look for. And if you don't act according to it, you won't get. Why? Why don't you get? It's sin. Why do you get? It's pious. Right? Yes?
All animals equally ignorant.
Are all animals equally ignorant? Yes. It's just a matter of what modes they're controlled by. So like a cow is controlled by goodness, right? A tiger or a lion by passion, a monkey by ignorance, right? But at the same time as the souls and all of them don't know who they are. They all think they're the body. It's just the modes that means the soul in the body of a cow is in ignorance. But the body of the cow is absorbed in the mode of goodness. So they like to be in a very clean atmosphere, nice atmosphere. You deal with them very nicely, right? You know, they live a very regulated lifestyle. The more regulated the lifestyle you make for them, the happier they are, you know. And, you know, so like that, that's their, you know, well, you know, monkeys aren't so worried about that, you know. They're irregulated and this and that and don't really care about that, you know. You know, you ever heard of monkeys taking bath? No, cows like to take... Every day at the same exact time they take a bath, they're very happy. Right? The place where they live is clean, this and that. You never think monkeys, they don't take baths. Just not, they just don't like it. You know, it's just like... Okay, so now that's just the one Swadharma. In other words, like acting according to nature, you can't get around. So then in here... Then now we brought around the two kinds of nature. Now the second kind is coming up here. Swadharma is ordained by the Lord, and this will be clarified in the fourth chapter. Right? So in other words, Krishna defines it. So it's not up to modern man to say they don't care. Or it doesn't apply in Kali Yuga. Right? God made Kali Yuga, and so he'll say what applies and doesn't. Right? On the bodily plane, Swadharma is called Varnashram Dharma, or man's stepping stone for spiritual understanding. Human civilization begins from the stage of Varnashram Dharma, or specific duties in terms of specific modes of nature of the body obtained. Discharging one's specific duty in any field of action, in accordance with the orders of higher authorities, serves to elevate one to a higher status of life. Right? So in other words, these are the nature, this is what you have to do. Now, you can just do that for a lower level, or you can do it for understanding that the ultimate Swadharma is the soul. Right? The soul, that's the ultimate nature. But because the soul is conditioned, therefore you act according to the material, the conditioned nature. So, the devotee deals with both at once. The materialist only deals with one. Right? Those who are liberated only have to deal with one also, but the spiritual. Right? So if they want to set example, they'll work within the system. Because the point is the Varnashram system means your conditioned nature and the particular position and relationships you have are there because of your previous karma. But what your karma is moving through, your options in the human field, are simply the reflection of the spiritual world that's in relationship to God. Because you don't see it in relationship to God, you're in the material world. And it's not generated in the spiritual world, the soul's eternal, the relationship with God's eternal, therefore there's one nature. You know, specific detail of the nature. But in the material world, because consciousness is constantly adjusting, therefore the form that you may have to perform your duties from keeps changing. Does that make sense? The Kshatriyas do the same thing in the spiritual world as they do here. Right? Jai and Vijay, do they have weapons? Right? Do they stand at doors? Do they look big and strong? Do they know how to fight? Right? So that's the spiritual world. They do the same thing. But it's in relationship to the Lord. Right? So the difficulty comes is, that's why the Swadharma here, there's not a problem in following it in connection with the Lord, because it's the same duties. But of the two, the attaining Krishna's satisfaction. That's the main. Right? So that's why there may be adjustments in the application of the Varnashram principles. The principles stay in place, but the detail changes. So if the principle is seen in connection with the Lord, then you'll find a detail that also will be in connection with the Lord.
So for urban
Varnashram,
we need to look for the
principles. For
urban.
Urban, well, here, it's just like this. Here's a subtle point. Human civilization begins from the stage of Varnashram Dharma. Right? Okay, now that's, you know, everybody jumps up and down and pro-Vedics become very happy and the anti-Vedic starts to become very sad. Right? But here is the point that both parties generally tend to miss. Or specific duties in terms of the specific modes of the nature of the body obtained. Right? That's your key, is what is it doing? It's just like this. Let us say I have a pile of pumpkins. Okay? No pumpkins? Okay. Now, I am sitting in the middle of a field. And I have these pumpkins and I'm talking with some person about buying them for more than it cost me to grow them. Okay, would that be considered business? Why? The profit is there, and I have the inclination to make profit in this way. Pumpkins is what I, you know, see as profitable. Okay? Now that guy will take it, you know, out of that farmland, and he'll take it to some small town, or some, you know, big, some village, and then he'll bring it there. And then there'll be, you know, that, and there'll be so many other people that have pumpkins. Okay? And then he will do what?
Sell it for a higher price.
Yeah, sell it for a higher price than he bought it from the farmer. Okay, now from there, then they put it in a truck and it goes into the city. You know, the big bad city. Right? And in the city, now, that person who's bought it from out in the town, what's he going to do? It's higher than he bought it in the town. Right? And then, having done that, now that goes into the wholesale market, and then a retailer will come along and buy, you know, 10 kilos of pumpkin instead of a truckload of pumpkin. Right? And then he's going to sit down, you know, either in that little market or on the pavement somewhere, and what is he going to do? Sell it for a higher price again. And where, and so, what is the common element between all these people in this chain?
They're inclined to make business and have a profit.
Yeah, they're inclined to make business and they know the science of the profit. Right. Now, we were not talking about some Abrahamic religion here. We were talking about how to make money. Okay? Like that. Okay? So now, is that man sitting in the, on the sidewalk of a street that all it is cement street, cement sidewalks, and immediately cement buildings. And he's selling his pumpkins. Is he any less of a businessman than the man who is sitting in the field in the village selling his pumpkins? No. Try explaining that to the pro-Vedics.
What they would say to the piece?
They'll say, unless you're sitting on the land, growing it, then it's not Varnashram. So in other words, they have no idea what Varnashram is. They think Varnashram is a form, just like, you know, Christianity. That's, you know, a science of God. But it's just a form. They don't understand the science. They're making the same mistake, taking the body to be the soul. Does that make sense? So that's why devotees, even though they're enthusiastic, they can't do it. Because the point is, it's what is your specific duties of the specific modes of your body. So if you have an urban nature, then you follow Varnashram in the city. You know what I'm saying? So that's why they can't establish it, because it has to be out in the farm. And how many farmers do we have in this movement? Go ahead. Get out, you know, pull out one hand and go ahead and list me all, you know, three of them. Okay, so maybe you can use two hands. You're more informed. You have a greater networking field. You know what I'm saying? But how many are there? Even if you take the whole movement of people, he knows how to, you give him land, he does something. Not the ones that sit around and talk and have a conference meeting and this and that and have to go to the city to make the money. No, I'm talking about he sees some land, he sees what's available locally, and he grows something. Yeah, there's very few of them, right? And probably most farm projects don't even have one like that. So the point is you're acting according to your nature, right? The kings, were they Kshatriyas? Yes. Where did they live? And where was the palace?
In the city.
You understand? This is a big... But at the same time as in the population, how much lived in the city and how much lived in the farm? That is, very few lived in the city. And, you know, I mean, now I think it's less, but I know up to, you know, some back in the 90s, 80s, 70s, when it's here, 80% of India lived in the village. Now I think it's a little bit less. But, so you can imagine if things were more vague, you might have 10%, 5%, 3%. But the point is...
Looking at Swami, give the figure 800 million Indians population going down.
Yeah, yeah. So the idea is that there's always been cities. Right? Always. Dwarka was a city. You know, Ayodhya was a city. There's always been cities, and Varnashram was practiced very nicely there. Right? It's said that Arjuna, when Yudhishthira went out into the forest, you know, I mean, it wasn't even a forest because nothing was there. It was kind of like a desert. In Kuru Jungala, then Krishna came and he called Indra and they made a city there, right? So they took a desert, made a city there, right? And then because it was there, then Yudhishthira started to, you know, generate the facilities. So Brahmins came and he was creating festivals and taking care of them and all that. So the Vaishyas saw an opportunity to make money. So they were coming with all their wares. You understand? So if you create the opportunity, Vaishyas are going to come. So that's not the problem. The problem is creating the Brahmins and Kshatriyas. Right? At the Panihati Utsav, right? Nityananda Prabhu told Raghunath Das, you know, you arranged this. So he went around to the villages and got, you know, chira and everything and milk and arranged it. And then what does Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami mention after that? He's already arranged stuff, but what was still going on? Vaishyas were still coming because they heard about this and they were bringing their stuff. So first he went out to contact them to make it. Then they were just coming because they heard that there's an opportunity. So these are real Vaishyas. Right? So they're coming. And then he's buying everything they have and then telling them to sit down and eat. Right? So they made profit and got lunch. So it was good. You know what I'm saying? So the point in here is that trying to arrange something in the village, then that's good because it's the most obvious. Right? It's very easy to identify. And it's the most natural and the most ideal manifestation. But the point is Varnashram applies everywhere. Have you ever heard? Are the demigods, what Varna are they? Kings. Okay. Amaravati, what is it? Big farm. Indra lives on this huge farm. It's a city. It's a huge city. Right? So the point is that you have the ideal manifestations and then you have other aspects that are needed to maintain the ideal. And then you have, you know, and that's all within the natural Vedic environment. In other words, if the city is not there, how are you going to see that the countryside is protected? Because you have to have a king, you have to have the administration, you have to have the armies, you have to have the treasury. So you're talking about millions of people. And then in doing this, you have to have the infrastructure to take care. So there's got to be Brahmins to train those people and teach the people and do all the rituals and all that. You're going to need Vaishyas to generate money and provide all the facilities that they're going to use. Shudras have to be there to assist. So it automatically happens. right? But it's for, to maintain that natural lifestyle, right? So now it's become reversed. The natural lifestyle is there to facilitate the living in the city. So that's reversed, but the principles of you can live varnashram in a city or in the country don't change. You know what I'm saying? You know, you're on a farm, you get up out of your house, you go over and ask, you know, the Vaishya man, okay, what do I do today? And he says, okay, you know, plow that field. Right? Or he gets up, he goes out, he gets on the subway, he goes to work, he goes to his boss and says, okay, what am I supposed to do today? He says, oh, I want you to, you know, fix these files. So is one any less a shudra than the other? No. But one is in a more natural, you know, you would say ideal environment, and one's not. But they're still performing Vaishya shudra duties, and the rules of being a shudra don't change. Right? The Vaishya in the village has to do what his boss says, and the shudra in the village has to do what his boss says, and the shudra in the city has to do what his boss said. Right? And the shudra in the village, he'll get profit from doing what he's been told. Either he'll get money, he'll give, be given grain, he'll be given facilities, whatever it is he'll get. And the one in the city, he'll get a check. Does that make sense? So there's in principle, there's no difference. So if you can't see the principle, you can't actually see, one, it's already working. Because Prabhupada said varnashram is going on anyway. It's just a matter of whether it's scientific or not. So scientific means it's trained, it's clear, everyone can tell who they are. Non-scientific means there's overlap, people don't quite know what to do, so people in one position do things they shouldn't. You know what I'm saying? You know, let's say you have a lawyer. He's supposed to be dealing with the law, not dealing with the law to make money. Right? He deals with the law, from that he gets taken care of. So that means it's not scientific. So the Brahmin as a lawyer in the modern scenario is not actually practicing scientifically Brahminical Dharma. That's why it creates problems, because it's not scientific. It's mixed. You know, it's, you know, it means, you know, this is Varna Shankara. It's mixed. Does that make sense? Yeah. So that's the point. If you can understand this, because if you can't, then how do you identify, okay, how do you identify who's the temple president? Who's the Sankirtan leader? Who's the treasurer? Who's the pujari? Right? You know, who's the cook? I mean, you can't just say, okay, you, and like that. You know, but it's not necessarily going to be so, work so well. So you can start like that. But after a while, who cooks? Yes, that's the problem. Yes, it used to be that others cooked. Just a funny thing on that. We used to have a pujari in Vrindavan. Prabhupada said, Omkar. And he was French. I mean, he was French. You know, like that, you know. And so, when he'd cook, but he would spend time in Mayapur and this and that. He was a very good cook. So he picked up the styles of cooking and flavorings of the Bengali cooking really well. But because he was French, when you look at the preparation, it would look French. But when you tasted it, it was Bengali. It was very far out. Yeah, so like that, you know, you get the, you know, you start, because the essential point's the taste, right? You know, so then you move from there. Like, would you rather have something? Yeah, okay. Something that looks like a pizza that doesn't taste like one, or something that doesn't necessarily look like one that tastes like one. Which would be good? Yeah. So taste is the essential. So that's the point in Varnashram, is that you get the essential point and manifest it how much you can. So in a rural environment, you can manifest so many aspects more. But in an urban environment, you can still manifest them, but they take on certain characteristics, that's all. So if you can't understand this, one will never understand Varnashram, and unfortunately never understand human life on the social level. One may end up philosophical and the soul and like that, devotional level. But this is the problem, is that the actual principles, and then we say, oh, principles, and just, okay, and so, but no, this is science. When you're talking principle detail, this is science, not art. Art is just you do something. Right? You're expressing how you feel. But how do you feel? You feel according to your nature. So what is your nature? So are you actually fully expressing what you feel? Right? So if you've expressed what you felt and you made profit, right, then you can say he's acting according to his nature as a Vaishya. But if he doesn't and he ends up in jail, then that wasn't smart. That wasn't acting according to his nature. You know, that he was trying to make profit, yes, that's why he got in jail, because the way he went about it was wrong. But the point is it wasn't the proper application. You know what I'm saying? You know, in other words, if he has to, you know, cheat and steal something, then get something that's more to source. You know what I'm saying? You go out in some place and, you know, drill a hole in the ground and take all the oil. Whose oil is it? It's somebody else's oil that you claim is my oil and you sell it. But no one will say you're cheating, even though you are. But if you move farther up on the line, you know, and that, then you take things there that aren't yours, then you're put in jail. Does that make sense? You know, so you have to find where that mentality will work.
Is that why politicians tend to steal?
Why politicians tend to steal? So you're saying that they should go into the forest, and so they would, because in the jungle you can take whatever you want, right? You know, they're in the wrong forum, like that. Yeah. Yes.
Right. This, that we take the essential point and manifest it as much as possible, does that mean as well that in our personal lives and in our mentality we can act according to our nature, but how much we can interact with the other people in the society will depend on them, right? Like how much we can show that in our relationships.
How we can show it? Why will it depend upon them?
Because
do you have control over them?
No.
So then it depends upon you. Varnashram, see, Varnashram is human life means what? Self-realization, atato brahma jigyasa, right? And so what is the lifestyle of someone who is interested in spiritual life? That's the Varnashram system, right? So the point is you have control over yourself. You don't have control over anyone or anything else. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So relationships start with you, right? Self-realization starts with you. Any endeavor and any starts with you. You don't do it, it doesn't happen. But we're dependent upon the Lord because we're God conscious. We know it's His system. We're working within His system. You understand?
Yeah. What I mean to say is that in acting in that lifestyle of someone who is trying to achieve self-realization, if other people around us, we will naturally interact with them in a certain way. But if they are not prepared to interact or to appreciate that kind of interaction.
No, but the point is okay, you're interested in self-realization, others may be not. Right? Or in a lesser degree. You deal with them, they don't appreciate it. But the point is you're dealing with them is about what? And they're saying, why are you interacting with them? You're into self-realization, why would you interact with someone else?
To help yourself in self-realization.
Okay.
Or
to help them. Okay. But the point is that are they a different individual?
Yes.
Do you have control over them?
No.
Okay. So therefore, if you want them to interact with you, then that means they have to appreciate how you're acting. Right? So that means you deal with them based on their nature.
Right.
Right? You can control your nature and how you deal with their nature. But you can't control them to deal with your nature. That's what people try to do. But that's the opposite of what actually works. So in other words, they're not interested in spiritual realization. What's the basis of your interaction? Just formal, ordinary things. You may see them in light of Krishna consciousness, but they don't. And so therefore you deal with them on that platform like that. You know what I'm saying? You know, you're walking down the street and some gentleman's walking down the street, you know, obviously a materialist, and you know, and he says, "Ah, good morning, you know, how are you today?" You know. So what are you supposed to do? You know, go, you know, respect to you, O servant of the Lord, the eternal soul, and like this man, what's wrong? I just said hello, you know. You know what I'm saying? They're saying you just reciprocate on that level. That's it. That's the point. Relationship means what's common. That's what you relate on, not what's different. Right? Does that make sense? You're God conscious. And let's say you have a relative who's not God conscious. Okay? So, relationship is based on what's common. So, what's common between you and that relative?
The family.
Family. So, you base it on that. You don't try to base it on God consciousness when they're not God conscious. Right? But what you do is not opposed to your God consciousness, because it's you acting, so you don't act opposed to your principles of acting, but you interface with them based on theirs. And then from doing that, you might find an opportunity where you can bring a commonality between your God consciousness and the family, and then you have something to go with. But you can't immediately just start if there's no connection. Right? I have a machine, and it needs to be plugged in, right? And there's a socket on the wall. What do I do? Just start, you know, pushing anywhere. You know, it's not. No, the point is it has to be in connection with the socket. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Right. So the point is if there's no connection, then you act on what is connected. And then if you can bring it around by your endeavor to something where there is a commonality between that person and your spiritual understanding, then that's the opening for preaching. Okay. Verses 38 to 53. Buddhi Yoga. In verses 10 to 30, the Lord defeated Arjuna's sentimental compassion for the bodies of his relatives. In verses 31 to 37, the argument based on sense enjoyment was rejected. In verse 38 to 53, Krishna defeats Arjuna's argument that fighting will bring about sinful reactions. In his commentary to verse 238, Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushan writes, right, because now he's going to say it's against Dharma, because he's saying do your duty, but he'll say, but if we do this, we'll incur sin. Because he's using elements of Dharma. But the thing is he's not applying those elements of Dharma to the situation that they're actually in. You understand? In other words, the Dharma always stands, but in the situation it applies to. Right? So if he was, you know, back at the palace and walked into Bhishma's room and that, then yes, he respects him. He wouldn't kill him. But they're on the battlefield. And they've declared war. So the scenario's changed. Now the Dharma of war applies. Right? Not the Dharma of teacher-student. Right? Teacher-student has an environment. So war has its environment. As we said, the place is part of it. Right? The circumstance is part of it. Now Bhishma, instead of being, you know, his teacher and protector, he's there on the battlefield to fight. Right? So the place has changed, the situation has changed. Right? Time has changed. This is now after the gambling match. Right? After they're being in the forest. So that has an effect. It was before the gambling match, it's a different thing. Does that make sense? So like that. Arjuna asks, you have explained by verse 33 and the verses following it that I will attain sin by not fighting, since I will be giving up my duty. But still, I should not fight because sin will arise from killing Brahmins and gurus in a war to gain a kingdom. Right? Because he's just like making it like there's occasional Brahmins and gurus and we're having this battle for the kingdom, and in the process, you know, all these Brahmins get killed. What he's leaving out is that the Brahmins and gurus are on the battlefield to kill him. Right? And they've declared war, and it's an agreed thing. It's not just, you know, he was there, he did something stupid, and his guru picked up a stick that, you know, hit him, and then he defends himself, and in the process kills his guru. No, we're not talking about that. You know? Krishna replies, it is not so. You will not incur sin by killing them when you are fighting with a desire for liberation. This is explained in this verse. Right? So, in other words, sin is, the point is what ultimately is sin? Right? Not pleasing the Lord. So, it's, these other things are scenarios in which Krishna decides what pleases him and what doesn't. So, in another scenario, then Krishna would want to be pleased by how he interacts with his superiors. But here, this is a different situation. So therefore, you please Krishna in this case by fighting. Right? You know, if he had said, yeah, I don't want to fight, and Krishna goes, yeah, no, it's a good point. Let's see how we can get out of this. But he didn't. Krishna consistently from the beginning to the end of the Gita is saying, perform your duty and fight. He never says any other option. Right? So Krishna's consistent. So it's very clear, obvious what Krishna wants. You know? Does this make sense? And he's brought out this point, it's bringing up now the Buddhi Yoga. That brings out that element. Is that the Buddhi Yoga means you're fighting with a desire for liberation. Means you're not fighting that the result is yours. Right? If the result's yours, then you have to be in the material world to receive the result. The world's, if the work is not yours, the result of the work is not yours, right? Then that means that same work, instead of taking you into material entanglement, will take you out. To that degree, it would take you in, now it will take you out. Right? So some big work will take you farther in, the same work done for Krishna will take you out. Does that make sense? So that's his point. So therefore, if you have the desire for liberation, that's what it'll be. So he's bringing this up, this liberation, but then he'll take it a step further to please Krishna. That's the ultimate liberation. Right? Because everything has an ultimate definition. Everything has an ultimate definition. Right? And that's always connected to Krishna. So your lower levels, because ultimately it is connected to Krishna, then the form of it may be something favorable. But it only actually becomes favorable when it's connected. Right? So that's how we can work with lower forms of things without a problem. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like, let's say, Prabhupada goes into somebody's loft in New York, some hippies in that, and they say, okay, you can stay over in this corner. And then, you know, they put up a few little sheets and that, and he stays in his corner and doesn't bother anything. Right? Because he's adjusting with the environment. Right? And then sees within that how to preach. Right? Sees the circumstance. You know, another situation where, you know, Swami and his brahmachari, they go and stay in a Hindu temple. They invite, you know, they allow to stay there and everything. And, you know, the other sadhus would come and stay. And specifically, I think there was one sadhu who would regularly stay there. And that, he wasn't there. And then the Swami and the brahmachari going through the place, because it's quite a mess, trying to clean it up because they're there, then go through and see he's got all this stuff that, you know, ants are eating and this and that, and just junk in their minds. So then they, you know, throw it out. But then the hosts get upset. Because the point is junk or no junk, it's not your junk. It's not your business to deal with it. But here it's like, you know, we're sadhus, you know, like that. This other guy's probably a bogus sadhu, like that. And, you know, we know the standards and he doesn't, and so we apply. But the point is it's not your environment to do that. Right? It's someone else's environment. Right? So the thing is here, is that you have to be able to see what is your position, therefore what your work is, and what your goal will be. Okay? So we'll stop here for today, and then we'll continue on Thursday with continuing Buddha Yoga. Oh, it's one of those.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinda ki, Janitai Gaura Premanandi.